Chapter 32. But Pitt, Maeve, and Giordino did not die. By early evening there was an easing of the wind, and the jumbled seas began to diminish shortly after. Unknown to them, the typhoon had veered off its earlier course from the northwest and suddenly headed southeast toward the Antarctic. The wind velocity noticeably slackened, down from over 150 kilometers to a little below 60. And the seas curtailed their madness, the distance between the wave crests and the troughs decreasing to no more than 3 meters. The rain thinned into a light drizzle that became a mist, hovering over the flattened swells. Overhead, a lone gull materialized from nowhere, before darkness swept the seas again and circled the little boat, screaming as if in stunned surprise at seeing it still afloat. In another hour, the sky was clear of clouds, and the wind was hardly strong enough to sail a sloop in. It was as if the storm were a bad dream that struck in the night and vanished with the soft light of day. They had won only one battle in a war with the elements. The savage seas and the cruel winds had failed to take them into the depths. What the great whirling storm could not destroy with its murderous fury, it rewarded with clemency. It seemed almost mystical, Maeve thought. If they were destined to die, they never would have lived through the storm. We were kept alive for a purpose, she decided staunchly. No word passed among the fatigued and battered trio huddled in the boat. Consoled by the calm in the wake of the departed tempest, exhausted beyond endurance, they entered a region of utterly uncaring indifference to their circumstances and fell into deep sleep. The swells retained a mild chop until the next morning, a legacy of the storm, before the seas became as liquid smooth as a millpond. The mist had long since faded, and visibility cleared to the far reaches of empty horizons. Now the sea settled down to achieve by attrition what it had failed to achieve by frenzied intensity. They slowly awoke to a sun they had sorely missed for the last 48 hours, but that now burned down on them with unrelenting severity. An attempt to sit up sent waves of pain through Pitt's body. The battering from the sea was added to the injuries he had suffered from John Merchant's men. Blinking against the dazzling glare of the sun's reflection on the water, he very slowly eased himself to a sitting position. There was nothing to do now but lie in the boat and wait. But wait for what? Wait in the forlorn hope that a ship might appear over the horizon on a direct course toward them? They were drifting in a dead part of the sea, far from the shipping lanes, where ships rarely sailed. Arthur Dorset had picked their drop-off point cleverly. If, through some divine miracle, they survived the typhoon, then thirst and starvation would take them. Pitt would not let them die, not after what they had been through. He took an oath of vengeance to live for no other reason but to kill Arthur Dorset. Few men deserved to die more. Pitt swore to overlook his normal codes and standards of ethics and morality, should he and Dorset ever meet again. Nor did he forget Boudicca and Deirdre. They too would pay for their depraved treatment of Maeve.
"It's all so quiet," said Maeve.
She clung to Pitt, and he could feel her trembling.
"I feel like the storm is still raging inside my head."
Pitt rubbed caked salt from his eyes, comforted in a small degree at feeling that the swelling had gone down. He looked down into the intensely blue eyes, drugged with fatigue and misted by deep sleep. He watched as they stared at him, and they began to shine. "Venus arising from the waves," he said softly. She sat up and fluffed out her salt-encrusted blonde hair.
"I don't feel like Venus," she said, smiling. "And I certainly don't look like her."
She pulled up her sweater and gently touched the red wheels around her waist, put there by the constant friction of the safety line. Giordino slipped open an eye.
"If you two don't quiet up and let a man sleep, I'm going to call the manager of this hotel and complain."
"We are going for a dip in the pool and then have some breakfast on the lanai," said Maeve with intrepid brightness. "Why don't you join us?"
"I'd rather call room service," Giordino drawled, seemingly exhausted by the mere act of speaking. "Since we're all in such a lively mood," said Pitt, "I suggest we get on with the business of survival."
"What are our chances of rescue?" asked Maeve innocently.
"Nil," answered Pitt. "You can bet your father dropped us in the bleakest part of the sea. Admiral Sandecker and the gang at Numa have no idea what happened to us. And if they did, they wouldn't know where to look. If we're to reach our normal life expectancy, we'll have to do it without outside help."
Their first task was to pull in the Steadfast sea anchor and remove their shoes and the tools and other items from Pitt's jacket. Afterward, they took an inventory of every single item, seemingly useless or not, that might come in handy for the long haul ahead. At last, Pitt removed the small packet that he had shoved down his pants just before driving the bus over the side of the dock.
"What did you find with the boat?" he asked Giordino.
"Not enough hardware to hang a barn door. The storage compartment held a grand total of 3 wrenches of various sizes, a screwdriver, a fuel pump, 4 spark plugs, assorted nuts and bolts, a couple of rags, a wooden paddle, a nylon boat cover, and a handy-dandy little number that's going to add to the enjoyment of the voyage."
"Which is?"
Giordino held up a small hand pump.
"This, for pumping up the flotation tubes."
"How long is the paddle?"
"A little over a meter."
"Barely tall enough to raise a sail," said Pitt.
"True, but by tying it to the console, we can utilize it as a tent pole to stretch the boat cover over us for shade."
"And lest we forget, the boat cover will come in handy for catching the water should we see rain again," Maeve reminded them.
Pitt looked at her. "Do you have anything on your person that might prove useful?"
She shook her head.
"Clothes only. My Frankenstein sister threw me on the raft without so much as my lipstick."
"Guess who she's talking about," Giordino muttered.
Pitt opened the small waterproof packet and laid out a Swiss Army knife, a very old and worn Boy Scout compass, a small tube of matches, a first aid kit no larger than a cigarette package, and a vest pocket 25 caliber Mauser automatic pistol with 1 extra clip.
Maeve stared at the tiny gun.
"You could have shot John Merchant and my father."
"Pickett stood a better chance at Gettysburg than I did with that small army of security guards."
"I thought you looked awfully well endowed," she said with a sly smile. "Do you always carry a survival kit?"
"Since my Boy Scout days."
"Who do you intend to shoot in the middle of nowhere?"
"Not who, but what."
"A bird, if one comes close enough."
"You'd shoot a defenseless bird?"
Pitt looked at her.
"Only because I have this strange aversion to starving to death."
While Giordino pumped air into the flotation tubes before working on a canopy, Pitt examined every square centimeter of the boat, checking for any leaks or abrasions in the neoprene floats and structural damage to the fiberglass hull. He dove overboard and ran his hands over the bottom but found no indication of damage. The craft appeared to be about 4 years old and had apparently been used as a shore boat when Dorset's yacht moored off a beach without a dock. Pitt was relieved to find it slightly worn, but in otherwise excellent shape. The only flaw was the missing outboard engine that no longer hung on the transom of the boat. Climbing back on board, he kept them busy all day with odd little jobs to take their minds off their predicament and growing thirst. Pitt was determined to keep their spirits up. He had no illusions as to how long they could last. He and Giordino had once trekked through the Sahara Desert without water for nearly 7 days. That was a dry heat. Here the heavy humidity sucked the life out of them. Giordino rigged the nylon cover as shield from the burning rays of the sun, draping it over the paddle he had mounted on the control console, and tying it down over the high sides of the flotation tubes with short lengths cut from the nylon line. He sloped one edge so that any rainwater it caught would flow and drop into an ice chest Maeve had found under one seat. She cleaned the grime from the long unused ice chest and did her best to straighten up the interior of the boat to make it livable. Pitt used his time to separate the strands from a section of nylon line and knot them into a fishing line. The only food source within 2,000 kilometers or more was fish. If they didn't catch any, they would starve. He fashioned a hook from the prong of his belt buckle and tied it to the line. The opposite end was attached to the center of one of the wrenches, so he could grip it with both hands. The quandary was how to catch them. There were no earthworms, trout flies, bass plugs, or cheese around here. Pitt leaned over the flotation tubes, cupped his hands around his eyes to shut out the sunlight, and stared into the water. Already, inquisitive guests were congregating under the shadow of the raft. Those who plow through the sea on ships and boats powered by big engines with roaring exhausts and thrashing propellers often complain that there is no life to be seen in the open ocean. But for those who float close to the surface of the water, drifting soundlessly, it soon becomes a window, opening on the other side on citizens of the deep, who are far more numerous and varied than the animals who roam the solid earth. Schools of herring-like fish, no larger than Pitt's little finger, darted and wiggled under the boat. He recognized pompano, dolphins, not to be confused with the porpoise and their larger cousins, the dorado, with their high foreheads and long fin running down the top of their multicolored iridescent bodies. A couple of large mackerel glided in circles, occasionally striking at one of the smaller fish. There was also a small shark, a hammerhead, one of the strangest inhabitants of the sea, each of his eyes perched on the end of a wing that looked like it was jammed into his head. "What are you going to use as bait?" asked Maeve. "Me," said Pitt. "I'm using myself as a gourmet delight for the little fishies."
"Whatever do you mean?"
"Watch and learn." Maeve stared in undisguised awe as Pitt took his knife, rolled up a pant leg, and calmly carved off a small piece of flesh from the back of his thigh. Then he embedded it on the improvised hook. It was done so matter-of-factly that Giordino did not notice the act until he saw a few drops of blood on the floor of the boat.
"Where's the pleasure in that?" he asked.
"You got that screwdriver handy?" Pitt inquired. Giordino held it up.
"You want me to operate on you, too?"
"There's a small shark under the boat," Pitt explained. "I'm going to entice it to the surface. When I grab it, you ram the screwdriver into the top of his head between the eyes. Do it right and you might stick his pea-sized brain." Maeve wanted no part of this business.
"Surely you're not bringing a shark on board?"
"Only if we get lucky," Pitt said, tearing off a piece of his T-shirt and wrapping it around the small gouge in his leg to staunch the bleeding. She crawled to the stern of the boat and crouched behind the console, happy to get out of the way.
"Mind you don't offer him anything to bite on."
With Giordino kneeling beside him, Pitt slowly lowered the human bait into the water. The mackerel circled it, but he jiggled the line to discourage them. A few of the tiny scavenger fish darted in for a quick nibble, but they quickly left the scene as the shark, sensing the small presence of blood, homed in on the bait. Pitt hauled in on the line every time the shark came close. As Pitt worked the hook and bait slowly toward the boat, Giordino, his upraised arm poised with the screwdriver held dagger fashion, peered into the deep. Then the shark was alongside, ashen gray on the back, fading to white on the belly, his dorsal fin coming out of the sea like a submarine raising its periscope. The screwdriver swung in an arc and struck the tough head of the shark as he rubbed his side against the flotation tubes. In the hand of most other men, the shaft would never have penetrated the cartilaginous skeleton of the shark, but Giordino rammed it in up to the hilt. Pitt leaned out, clamped his arm under the shark's belly behind the gills, and heaved just as Giordino struck again. He fell backward into the boat, cradling the 1.5-meter hammerhead shark in his arms like a child. He grabbed the dorsal fin, wrapped his legs around the tail, and hung on. The savage jaws were snapping but found only empty air. Maeve cringed behind the console and screamed as the bristling triangular teeth gnashed only centimeters away from her drawn-up legs. As if he were wrestling an alligator, Giordino threw all his weight on the thrashing beast from the sea, holding down the body on the floor of the boat, scraping the inside of his forearms raw on the sandpaper-like skin. Though badly injured, the hammerhead displayed an incredible vitality. Unpredictable, it was aggressive one minute and oddly docile the next. Finally, after a good 10 minutes of futile thrashing, the shark gave up and lay still. Pitt and Giordino rolled off and caught their breath. The writhing fight had aggravated Pitt's bruises, and he felt like he was swimming in a sea of pain.
"You'll have to cut him," he gasped to Giordino. "I feel as weak as a kitten."
"Rest easy," Giordino said. There was a patience, a warm understanding in his voice. "After the beating you took on the yacht and the pounding from the storm, it's a wonder you're not in a coma."
Although Pitt had honed the blades on his Swiss Army knife to a razor edge, Giordino still had to grip the handle with both hands and exert a great deal of muscle in slicing through the tough underbelly of the shark. Under Maeve's guidance as a professional marine zoologist, he expertly cut out the liver and made an incision in the stomach, finding a recently eaten dorado and several herring. Then Maeve showed him how to slice the flesh from inside the skin efficiently.
"We should eat the liver now," she advised. "It will begin decaying almost immediately, and it is the most nutritious part of the fish."
"What about the rest of the meat?" asked Giordino, swishing the knife and his hands in the water to remove the slime.
"It won't take long to spoil in this heat."
"We've got a whole ocean of salt. Slice the meat into strips, then string it up around the boat. As it dries, we take the salt that has crystallized on the canopy and rub it into the meat to preserve it."
"I hated liver when I was a kid," said Giordino, somewhat green around the gills at the thought. "I don't think I'm hungry enough to eat it raw."
"Force yourself," said Pitt. "The idea is to keep physically fit while we can. We've proven we can supply our stomachs. Our real problem now is lack of water."
Nightfall brought a strange quiet. A half-moon rose and hung over the sea, leaving a silvery path toward the northern horizon. They heard a bird squawking in the star-streaked sky, but couldn't see it. The cold temperatures common to the southern latitudes came with the disappearance of the sun and eased their thirst a little, and their minds turned to other things. The swells beat rhythmically against the boat and lulled Maeve into thoughts of a happier time with her children. Giordino imagined himself back in his condominium in Washington, sitting on a couch, an arm draped around a pretty woman, one hand holding a frosty mug of Coors beer, and his feet propped on a coffee table, as they watched old movies on television. After resting most of the afternoon, Pitt was wide awake and felt revitalized enough to work out their drift and forecast the weather by observing the shape of the clouds, the height and run of the waves, and the color of the sunset. After dusk, he studied the stars and attempted to calculate the boat's approximate position on the sea. Using his old compass while locked in the storage compartment during the voyage from Wellington, he noted that the yacht had maintained a southwest heading of 240 degrees for 20 minutes short of 30 hours. He recalled John Merchant saying the yacht could cruise at 120 kilometers an hour. Multiplying the speed and time gave him a rough distance traveled of 3,600 kilometers from the time they left Wellington until they were set adrift. This, he estimated, would put them somewhere in the middle of the South Tasman Sea, between the lower shores of Tasmania and New Zealand. The next puzzle to solve was how far were they driven by the storm. This was next to impossible to estimate with even a tiny degree of accuracy. All Pitt knew for certain was that the storm blew out of the northwest. In 48 hours it could have carried them a considerable distance to the southeast, far from any sight of land. He knew from experience on other projects that the currents and the prevailing winds in this part of the Indian Ocean moved slightly south of east. If they were drifting somewhere between the 40th and 50th parallels, their drift would carry them into the desolate vastness of the South Atlantic, where no ship traveled. The next landfall would be the southern tip of South America, nearly 13,000 kilometers away. He stared up at the Southern Cross, a constellation that was not visible above 30 degrees north latitude, the latitude running across North Africa and the tip of Florida. Described since antiquity, its five bright stars had steered mariners and flyers across the immense reaches of the Pacific since the early voyages of the Polynesians. Millions of square miles of loneliness, dotted only by the islands, which were the tips of great mountains that rose unseen from the ocean floor. However he figured it, no matter how strong their desire to survive, and despite any good luck they might receive,
The odds were overwhelming against their ever setting foot on land again.